And I will do justice to justices.
For the Supreme Court of Ohio.
I got it.
Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in open session pursuant to adjournment.
You may be seated. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. We are here on our first case, 13-1400, Donald Lee versus the Village of Cardington, Ohio. For the appellant, Mr. Latchney.
May it please the court, Chief Justice and the justices, I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. What brings us here this morning is the Court of Appeals decision which applied the whistleblower statute to third-party conduct. The Village of Cardington, in this case, committed no crime. There was no evidence.
Counselor, could you just move the microphone up to, that'd be
sure.
Great. Thank you.
There was no evidence in this case, and as Mr. Lee admitted at his deposition, there was no evidence in this case that the Village faced any fines, penalties, loss of permits at any point in time. Mr. Lee consistently testified throughout his deposition that each time there was a test done, that the Village passed the test, and in fact, in December of 2008, he reported to Village Council that the Village was still meeting its EPA permits. And thus, the question before you is whether the Village can be responsible for, under the whistleblower statute, for the criminal environmental conduct of Cardington Yutaka Technologies. I submit to you the answer is no. As I was preparing for oral argument, sometimes you miss little things that you didn't realize. And one of the things I looked at was the caption of the statute. The caption for 4113.52 is reporting violation of law by employer or fellow employee. And while I realize that the captions are not necessarily binding in the sense of applying the statute, I think it does give great insight into what the Ohio General Assembly intended when they passed the law.
Counsel, your friends on the other side, I'm over here. Your friends on the other side say that he did report criminal activity by the Village, who was his employer. How do you respond to that?
Justice French, I have a response to that in a number of ways. We'll start with the second part of the statute, which is 4113.52A2, which does not require the written report. It can be an oral report, and you can go outside to the EPA or whoever. That has a specifically delineated number of Ohio administrative codes and Ohio revised code sections, which, for example, in 6111.99, it defines what is the criminal conduct under that chapter. The only section that Mr. Lee relied upon had to do with sludge disposal. And this occurred in, there was a report to Village Council about this problem with this sludge in 2007. And what happened was, there was apparently, according to Mr. Lee, there was apparently some discussion about he won't take this sludge anymore because he was the one that had the EPA permit, not the Village, to take this sludge onto his farmland.
So to get to the bottom line, you would say that he may have said there was activity. There might have been permit violations under 6111, but not criminal activity.
Well, there wasn't any criminal activity by either the Village or Mr. Lee. Basically, his suggestion was, and what he alleges in his complaint, is the Village had talked about taking the sludge to another farmer's farm, but it never happened. The actus reus never occurred. What happened instead was it was discussed at a Village Council meeting on August 20th, 2007, and Village Council took the sludge to an approved landfill. The EPA has certain landfills where you can take this toxic sludge to and dispose of it there. And the Village began a program, which continued throughout his entire employment, of disposing of the sludge properly. there was no evidence in the record that the village ever actually violated 6111.04 because there was no sludge ever disposed of improperly. So there isn't any evidence in the record to establish that the village violated 6111.04, which is the only statute which could possibly apply under A2 because it's the only one referenced in the .99 statute.
Counsel, in the appellate opinion, paragraphs 23 and 24, the Court of Appeals talks about the glycol not being filtered out of the water, and they say that the affidavit said that the dumping of glycol threatened to cause the permit violation, exposing the village to criminal liability. And then in paragraph 24 says, if it exceeds these levels, the village is violating the law, and therefore they found that the appellant complained of the criminal conduct. How do you answer that?
Your Honor, there isn't anything specifically in A2 which addresses that particular issue. And so what needs to happen is you have to go to A1, which requires a written report by the employee to the employer. And the written report requirement was not fulfilled in this case.
Well, didn't he send a written report to Mr. Riley?
Mr. Riley, the only written report, which was never produced by the plaintiff and was never introduced into evidence, and we believe it doesn't exist, but he claims that there was a written report regarding equipment failures and that he was complaining about the fact that the village had hired an engineering firm and it was going to cost the village $750,000 or $800,000 to perform these corrective measures when he felt that there were alternative, less expensive ways to address these issues. But that doesn't implicate the whistleblower statute if what he was complaining about was equipment failures, because the statute addresses felony criminal activity, environmental crimes.
Counsel, therefore, is the Court of Appeals wrong when they say the report delineated damage occurring as a result of the dying bacteria? That's not equipment, is it? Paragraph 9, the Court of Appeals said that he was talking in his written report to his supervisor about dying bacteria caused by the glycol in the wastewater.
There was a report of that in 2007, and what happened was is the Ohio EPA came in and did tests, and they determined that the village was not the cause or source of the problem. And then the federal EPA came in early in 2008 and confirmed what the Ohio EPA had already done, that the village was not the cause or the source of the problem. And in fact, Mr. Lee's testimony is the evidence in that regard.
Couldn't an argument be made that once the village is passing toxic substances into the natural water supply, the village is involved?
Well,
without regard to where the chemical is starting, obviously it's starting at a plant somewhere, but once it goes through your wastewater treatment plant and it is going into the river water, isn't the village involved, and therefore doesn't that make him a whistleblower?
Okay, let me answer the first part of your question first. The water that was going out never tested as being beyond any level which would violate the permit. The village never violated, and there's no evidence in this case, and there's no allegation either, that the village ever violated its EPA permit. So think about it. When wastewater is being discharged constantly over a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week period, in order to determine that there is some violation, somebody has to go out there physically and take a sample or do a test. And then that sample has to be sent to a lab or whatever to figure out, okay, we're going to determine what the level of the glycol in the water is. And there's no evidence between at any point in time that the village was ever in violation of its EPA permit. And there's,
well, the village was never even the subject of criminal prosecution here. They were, in fact, the victim.
That's what I've been saying all along, Your Honor.
Okay.
And in fact,
the CYT ended up with a criminal charge, correct?
That's correct.
And $500,000 in restitution.
Correct.
And that restitution went to the village to restore the damage that was done.
Correct.
Okay. And this was all on the table, according to the deposition of Mr. Lee. Everybody knew what was going on, what the allegations were, correct?
Correct.
So my question is, who did he blow the whistle on?
I can't answer that question, Your Honor, because I don't know. I don't believe Mr. Lee ever blowed the whistle. When I sent a public records request to the Ohio EPA and also to the federal EPA, and I asked them, provide me with anything you possibly have from Mr. Lee, whether it's your notes of verbal conversations or written reports or anything you have. And the response I got from both of them, one is memorialized in an affidavit from Mike Sapp, who is the Ohio EPA investigator who did the investigation and ruled out the village as the cause. He said he didn't have anything from Mr. Lee. In fact, all the written documentation came from either Mr. Raleigh, the village administrator, or Mr. Chapman, who was the license holder. Because normally, the EPA deals with the person who holds the wastewater treatment license, not persons who are not licensed to participate in that process.
So what was the reason for Lee's termination from employment?
There were a number of issues which arose.
When?
During the, I would say, the latter half of 2008. And I think they came to a head at a point in time where Mr. Lee went on vacation for 2 weeks. And then he called in and told Mr. Raleigh he was going to take a third week off. He didn't have prior authorization to do so. And one of the things that the village discovered was that there were a lot more getting done while Mr. Lee was gone in terms of projects being completed, because village council members had noted that there had been a difficulty completing projects. For example, the fire chief complained that he needed a fire hydrant fixed. He came to council 3 times, and it was Mr. Lee's responsibility to make sure that the fire hydrant got fixed. The fire chief's position was that it was a safety problem, and it never got fixed. Another council member—
Oh, it was a performance issue outside of anything related to the CYT problem.
Correct. The other thing I wanted to note, which really isn't discussed in the briefs, but I think it's worth mentioning, and that is when Mr. Lee first brought up this issue about the sludge before the Ohio EPA got involved in 2007, there was over a 20-month gap between the time he first complained and the EPA came on the scene and the time he was terminated, or I should say initially placed on administrative leave in April of 2009 and ultimately terminated in June of 2009. And I would submit to you that in retaliation cases, normally in order to find causation or the temporal proximity between the adverse employment action and the activity, you usually are looking at a period of 2 to 3 months or less in time. In other words, this isn't a situation where village council woke up one day and said, oh, we need to terminate Mr. Lee in April or 2009 because of something he reported in early 2007.
Well, counsel, I guess that gets back to my original question. I don't think I've heard the answer yet.
Oh.
I'm looking at the Court of Appeals, and it seems to me the Court of Appeals, on a summary judgment basis, found that this was a whistleblower by virtue of the fact that he used, and I want to speak precisely, they were sending toxic water downstream. That is what he said the village was doing. Doesn't that make him a whistleblower when he goes to the council and makes that allegation, even if it's not true?
you have to have a reasonable and good faith belief, and it has to be based upon some facts.
Who makes that determination?
I suppose the court makes that determination, whether the employee has presented sufficient evidence that there is a reasonable and good faith belief. But the problem is that both the Iowa EPA and the federal EPA, before he went to counsel, because he went to counsel later in 2008, both had ruled out the village as the cause of the problem. And secondly, again, there was no evidence ever that the village ever violated its permit. In other words, that the level being discharged into the water ever exceeded the amount permitted by the EPA.
So are you saying that a false allegation or a misunderstood allegation is not sufficient for the whistleblower status? Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
To create an issue of fact for the jury?
Yes, I mean, how could he, in good faith, believe, after the Ohio EPA and the federal EPA told him, he's the one that volunteered the testimony, after they told him that the village had been ruled out as the cause or source of any problem, and secondly, he knew, I mean, it was his testimony I was relying on, he knew that the village had never violated its permit, ever. So if there was no violation, if he knew there was no violation of the permit, even as late as December 1, 2008, which is referenced in Plaintiff's Exhibit 4, what he told village council is, quote, "we still meet permit," end quote.
So a whistleblower has to be accurate. Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Before there's protection for a later firing.
Well, there has to be some degree of accuracy. I mean, you have to, I don't understand how Mr. Lee could be thinking that the village committed a criminal violation when all of the focus of the EPA's efforts were on Cardington-Utaka Technologies, not the village.
So there would be no good faith reliance by Mr. Lee on criminal activity that needed to be reported to the village.
Correct.
Okay.
And Judge, the other problem is that the amount of information that the village had was fairly limited. In other words, the record's clear that Mr. Lee alleges that he orally reported this problem concerning glycol, but what he didn't do was say that the village was violating the statute. In other words, he didn't tell the village, "I believe you're doing something wrong." To the contrary, what he said was, "we were working with the Ohio, and then it turned into the federal EPA criminal division to resolve the problem we were trying to solve." And this was at brief page 8, Lee deposition 144-145. The village had a cooperative relationship with the EPA all along. The EPA was never after the village. And so, and Mr. Lee knew that. So how could he reasonably believe the village was violating any EPA regulations or their permits when he knew that, one, they were meeting their permit even after he reported this to the village council?
All right, let me ask you, you also have to have a nexus between what was allegedly reported and the firing, that there can't be an intervening basis, such as you allege here, and that's poor job performance, subsequent to the resolution of this EPA issue.
Correct. One of the things, and you know, I asked the Court of Appeals to take judicial notice of the fact that the Southern District of Ohio had found Cardington-Utaka Technologies entirely responsible and that the village was entitled to restitution. And, you know, the Court of Appeals chose in the exercise of its discretion not to take judicial notice of that opinion. But I think the one thing that it does is that it confirms that the village was in fact the victim here. I mean, there's no indication anywhere in the record.
When did the village get the money from Utaka Technologies?
The trial court decision from the Southern District of Ohio was October 1, 2012. The state court decision from the Common Pleas Court that the Ohio Attorney General was involved in was January 24, 2013. It was sometime after that. Okay. I don't know precisely when.
All right.
I believe, if I'm not mistaken, that CYT had 90 days to pay the community service portion.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Coleman.
May it please the court, I'm Michael Coleman. I represent the appellee, the plaintiff below, Donald Lee. Don Lee, who also serves as a township trustee, cares about our environment. He also owns a farm, and he uses quite a few organic methods in his farming processes. He's concerned about our water quality. He could have accepted at face value what the EPA told him back in 2007, that everything in the wastewater treatment plant was proper as far as the procedures they were using, and left it at that, but he didn't. He knew that something was killing the bacteria in the plant. He knew that something was altering the quality of the water being returned to the Whetstone Creek.
Counsel, I want to follow up on Justice Lansinger's question because I think it's at the heart here. Does a whistleblower have to be accurate to have whistleblower status?
The whistleblower in this case, Your Honor, has to have a reasonable belief in the truth of the allegations which he is making. In this particular case, Your Honor, Mr. Lee had a legitimate good faith belief that the village, and not Cardington, Utaka, but that the village was also either violating its permit or in danger of violating its permit.
And what just did he base that on? Counsel, right here. Counsel, up here.
I'm sorry.
Right here.
Sorry, Your Honor.
What did he base that on? What did he base this belief on? Because the EPA said that the permit was not violated. Yes, they knew the bacteria was dying, and they knew that glycol was being introduced, and they found the culprit that was introducing the glycol. So what did he base his belief on? You said he had a good faith reliance and a reasonable belief.
Oh, several things, Your Honor. First of all, the bacteria is what controls the operation of the plant. It controls what exactly gets eaten and what gets dissolved.
Yeah, we understand how it works.
All right. The glycol was something that was determined was in the water very late in the process. You know, we talk about 2007, we talk about 2008. Even at that point, they didn't necessarily know that it was glycol, what the actual compound it was that was causing these problems. Now, what did Mr. Lee see in answer to your question? He saw damages to the equipment. He saw corroding concrete. He saw diffusers and pumps that were being destroyed by this. The glycol was not, of course, making the bacteria work properly, so that the effluent was not the proper consistency, and this was all damaging the operation of the plant, all forms of equipment, which is what he put in that report. And of course, if that's happening, then he has a legitimate good faith belief that the water that is being returned to the creek, and it's about 200,000 gallons a day, is not of the proper consistency. It's not been properly treated.
And did the EPA agree with him?
The EPA was concerned that would happen.
Did the EPA produce a report that agreed with your client's suspicions?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor.
I have
not seen one.
So did he have a report from any other source that said the water that is being returned from the village of Cardington's water treatment plant did not meet the permit specifications? Did he have an independent lab? Did he have any documentation that would have said that?
What he had, Your Honor, was they had finally determined through their lab testing from the EPA that glycol was coming into the plant.
All right.
And that glycol needed to be removed.
I understand that.
It was being returned to the water.
Oh, counsel, they have a report that said that the water that was treated and being returned to the system violated the permit levels.
I'm not aware of one.
Okay, so they didn't. The answer is no. You didn't have one. The EPA didn't have a report. You didn't have an independent report. There was no scientific verification to support your client's suspicion that the water quality was beyond the permit level.
Well, no report, I guess, putting it exactly the way you put it, Your Honor.
Well, wouldn't that be necessary for him to, for the village of Cardington to be held criminally liable or potentially even criminally liable here?
No, no. He had a reasonable good faith belief once he found out through scientific evidence that this glycol was in the water. The glycol had to be removed. They needed to figure out a way to get that out of the water. Now, we don't have a report from the EPA yet that said that, but he knew that the glycol had to be taken out of the water, and it was going into the creek. I mean, it was moving right through the plant. Not only was it messing up all of the operation of the plant, but it's going into the creek, and they knew that. They knew that because it's coming in.
Do you think the EPA knew that and decided to ignore that?
Didn't say they ignored it, Your Honor. That's what they were working to try to rectify the problem.
So they were working, and they were working with the village, correct?
They were working with the village, and they were trying to eliminate the problem.
And the village was the victim.
What's that?
The village here was the victim of this discharge of glycol by CYT.
Part of the problem, yes. Yes, they were the part of the CYT damaged the village by causing problems with the village's wastewater treatment plant. Now, Mr. Lee was also reporting to the village that he thought that it was illegal for the village to be not dealing with the problems in the plant, which were their responsibility to deal with.
Counsel, that gets us to the bigger question today. Your opposing counsel says very persuasively, well, that was a long time between when he talked to counsel and when he got fired. How do we, since this went out on summary judgment, I find this to be a very thin record. How do we make a link between if we were to call him a whistleblower and his termination?
Let me first just note for the court that it was first raised in this court. This issue was not raised. All of the reasons for his termination were never raised in either one of the courts below. They were raised here for the first time. To answer your question, however, Your Honor, that supervisor's report that he gave to Mr. Rally was done at the suggestion of Mr. Barlow from the federal EPA, and it was very close to his termination. It wasn't a year and a half before. And we're also, one thing I heard continually during
Can you give me dates on that, months or years? The report that went to Mr. Rally and the termination?
It would have been, I believe he testified that it was after the first of the year, 2009, so it was in months of his termination.
Okay. And was that the report that the equipment was failing?
That was a report that the equipment was failing. It was a report that said that it was on account of the glycol and that it was altering the operation of the plant and that the bacteria was dying.
Was it in writing?
Yes, it was. And we've asked for it to be produced as well, Your Honor. It hasn't been produced to us.
Well, it was a report that your client generated.
That's correct.
And he doesn't have a copy of it.
I keep a copy of it, Your Honor.
And he submitted it to Mr. Rally.
Mr. Rally, who, by the time we filed the lawsuit, was no longer employed there.
Was it also presented to the council?
We don't think it was, Your Honor. The council member said that it wasn't.
That was an oral presentation.
The one that the Court of Appeals is referring to?
Yes.
Yes, that was something he presented to them orally.
All right.
Counsel, did your complaint specifically allege, what did the complaint specifically allege? What was the specific statutory violation that would make up a 6111 violation?
We alleged violations in the operation of the plant. We alleged that the state and federal EPA laws were violated.
But you didn't allege a specific statute?
Did not allege a specific statute. It was notice pleading, Your Honor. Never got a motion to dismiss. And I cited a case in the courts below that said that it's our responsibility to identify those statutes at the summary judgment phase.
And that's where we are now.
I'm sorry?
That's where we are now, is the summary judgment.
That's correct.
Stage. So in your motion for summary judgment then, did you say these are the specific statutes that were violated?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
And what were they?
I set forth all of them.
What were they?
6111.04C. Let me just get the 2927.24B1, are the two specific environmental statutes.
Okay.
We also set forth a number of environmental regulations in the brief, which I don't have right in front of me. And we also set forth a number of ordinances from the village of Cardington that also were being violated and that also could have been used as far as the notion of the authority of the employer to correct the violation.
Okay, thank you.
And are you saying, in answer to Justice O'Neill's question, that the report that was submitted to Mr. Raleigh was followed by his termination from employment?
That's correct.
How many months or years?
It would have been just a few months, Your Honor.
So
two
you
or three
think
months.
As a result of submitting the report to Raleigh, that was the basis of the termination?
Yes, and the continued... He continually reported these problems to Mr. Raleigh, and the evidence shows that Mr. Raleigh finally just had enough and came to him and terminated him, giving him no reason whatsoever for the termination. He was never counseled about his job performance. He was never told that his
Is there a termination letter?
He was placed on administrative leave for two months, and then the council...
Was that in writing?
So I think that would be in writing, yes.
And what was the basis of that?
There was no basis given that I'm aware of.
What was in writing?
Just that he was terminated. I wanted to respond to
Council,
one of
the... What about this case takes it beyond being fact-specific as to whether or not your client's claim should have been bounced at summary or there was enough to proceed further on?
Your Honor, that's pretty much how I've always viewed the case, is that most of it is a question of fact. I suppose that the one issue that may not be quite as clear is whether or not the actions, his complaints about what happened with Cardington Utaka Technologies is covered by the whistleblower statute. And as we've argued in our brief and amicus have argued, we believe that the statute does provide authority for correction of violations by third parties. And otherwise, we've always viewed this as primarily a case where it's factually based and it needs to be resolved by a trier of fact. I would like to point out that this case involves really three forms, if you will, of whistleblowing. And we've talked a lot about the first one, which is covered by 4113A1. And we've talked some about the second type, which is also covered by 4113A1 and 2, which involves reports of violations by a third party. But there's also the violation that's covered by 4113A2, and that has to do with the violation of 6111.03.04C, where when he notices a violation and he reasonably believes that there's problems with this permit, he can go directly to the EPA and talk about this problem. I mean, everybody says, oh, it's gotta be a complaint or a report. He reported it. He was constantly talking with Mr. Sapp and Mr. Barlow about this problem, and there doesn't have to be a separate written report to the employer. He's allowed to go straight to the EPA. And that's something that really wasn't addressed at all by the trial court. The Court of Appeals did recognize that, but there hasn't been very much discussion of that today, so I wanted to emphasize that.
So the fact that these things are being done, you're saying that is enough to give protection against a firing later on? The nexus is the thing that I'm concerned about, because I thought the whistleblower statute was there to say, employers, you may not fire for this particular reason. And it seems as though you're not making that connection. You're just saying that if these things are done, and then later on there happens to be a firing, they're automatically connected. Is that what you're saying?
I understand. No, it's not, Your Honor. The conversations that Mr. Lee was having with the EPA were ongoing. They were weekly. It was something that they were trying to deal with on a constant basis. And Mr. Rowley knew this. Mr. Rowley knew that he was making these reports to the EPA.
You're not saying the village violated an EPA permit restriction, are you?
I'm saying that Mr. Lee was concerned that if this continued to happen, that it could violate the permit, and it may have been violating the permit at
the
time of his termination.
There's no evidence that the permit was violated, is there?
Sorry?
There's no evidence the permit was violated.
No evidence in the record. That's right, Your Honor. But the permit specifies what you're allowed to put
back. How can an EPA violation be the basis of a whistleblower claim if there isn't any evidence that there is an EPA violation?
If he has a reasonable good faith belief that there is, and the permit says this is the amount of material you're allowed to put into the creek.
He believes something's being violated, but the evidence shows it's not being violated, and that's the basis of a whistleblower claim. That's what you're
arguing. The evidence ultimately shows, and if he has a reasonable good faith belief that there's a violation.
Counsel, if you get beyond summary, which is where the Court of Appeals put you at this point, right?
I'm sorry, were they?
The outcome of the Court of Appeals puts you beyond summary.
That's right.
All right.
They've remanded for a trial.
So now you get to a trial. For your client to prevail, he's got to establish not only was he making these reports to the council, to the village administrator, to the EPA, but that he had, you've got to prove to a jury that he had a reasonable belief that there may be violations of the law. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And then you have to also prove that his firing was not for other reasons.
That's correct.
So you've got all of those to overcome for him to be successful.
In this particular case, Your Honor, he was given no reason for the termination.
Well, but the law doesn't require any employer to give a reason, does it?
That is correct, but there is, as I set forth in our brief, there is, I believe, a tremendous amount of evidence that this is pretext, that the reasons articulated after the fact are all pretext. He was never warned about any of them. He was never counseled about any of them. Any reasonable investigation would have shown that these were not the reason for his termination.
Well, counsel, in the Court of Appeals opinion of paragraph 23, they go through, the appellant indicated to his supervisor and the village council the glycol was not being filtered out and there was problems at the water treatment plant. And then the court says the dumping of the glycol threatened to cause the village to violate its permit, thereby exposing the village and its officials to criminal liability. This is what the Court of Appeals says.
That's correct.
All right, and that's speculative. Glycol threatened to cause the village to violate its permit. Not that said that it did, because it didn't have any evidence that it did. And then they further speculate that even if that was an elevated level of glycol, it exposes the village and its officials to criminal liability. There's no finding that they were criminally liable for anything. The village permit was governed by our revised code 3745 and 6111. The permit specifies the levels of various compounds, chemicals, or elements permitted in the water and returned to the state water supply following treatment. If the levels are exceeded, the village is violating the law. Again, if there is nothing in the record to indicate it was, and it says revised code 2927-24B1 makes it unlawful to knowingly place a hazardous chemical or harmful substance in a public water. Well, nobody disputes that, but it says the statute provides for criminal penalties. Accordingly, we find appellant complained of criminal conduct. With regards to this village, he didn't. There is no criminal conduct that the village was orchestrating.
I would submit to the court that under the whistleblower statute and the language of the whistleblower statute that he's not required to actually have a scientific finding that there's a violation of the law. Mr. Lee is not a scientist. He doesn't have all the equipment to go out and make these tests, and it's not required that he actually go out and find the evidence of it. Many of these whistleblowing incidents would never ever be reported if that was the case. All that's necessary is that he have a reasonable good faith belief that there's a violation going on, and then the employer can look and see if that's
well,
the case.
Counsel, I'm certainly no expert, or I have barely a passing knowledge of how this EPA business all works with respect to water quality. But I would assume that when a city or village discovers we got a problem, something's coming in here and messing with our whole treatment plant, and they're communicating with the EPA, which was going on here, right? Your client was communicating with them saying,
that's correct.
We've got this going on. We don't know what to do about it. It's hard for me to imagine that the EPA would then bring criminal actions against a public body that's doing everything they can and seeking the assistance of the EPA to find out the source and figure out what to do about it. It would be different if they were trying to hide it from the EPA, and your client knew about that. But when they're seeking the assistance, cooperation, what do we do about this? Help us find the source. Tell us what we can do with our water. Can that lead to a criminal violation for the village?
Well, in this particular situation, Your Honor, what we have is we have Mr. Lee, while we're dealing with this overall problem, he's telling them, look, you've got to take certain actions to get this plant working within the confines of its
permit. What did he suggest they do?
He suggested several things that need to be done as far as replacing and repair of the equipment. And also, they knew that they had to get that glycol out of the water. Now, I'm not aware that he's...
How did he recommend that they get the glycol out of the water?
I'm not aware of any specific solution.
Well, he didn't know how to do it.
Probably not, Your Honor. That's something that he would have to investigate and find out how you do it.
He didn't even have, again, a water quality report that would have indicated that there was dangerous levels of glycol emanating from that plant.
Did he have... No.
No, he didn't.
He had the evidence of what the EPA had discovered and had discovered that it was glycol that was coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Counsel, you've used your time. You may take a minute.
Thank you very much for the additional minute. But one thing I wanted to point out was that Mr. Lee testified that I asked him specifically about the glycol report to written counsel, and he said at 107 of his deposition, everything I did was verbal. That's my fault. I don't do that sort of thing. So when it came to trying to fulfill the written report requirement regarding the glycol report, he didn't do it. That's why, you know, sort of a shell game here. The written report was about the equipment failures, not about the glycol's effect on the sewer treatment plant.
Was his deposition testimony different from his affidavit?
It was. And one other thing I wanted to point out was at affidavit paragraph 22, when he talked about the purpose of that oral report to village council, he said village council could use the report as a tool to seek reimbursement from CYT. So his purpose in reporting to village council was not to tell village council, you're violating the law, you need to do something about this. It's in his affidavit, seek reimbursement from CYT. That was his purpose.
So it's for civil action at some point.
Right, so that the village, and ultimately the village did. The village ended up through the criminal process getting the $515,000 in restitution.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We will take the matter under advisement, gentlemen. You'll receive our opinion.